Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The words of Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert following the capture of two Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah militants in northern Israel during a cross-border raid early today. A Hezbollah spokesperson, speaking to the BBC, says that the capture of the two soldiers is not related to the kidnapping of an Israeli soldier by Palestinian Hamas militants 2 weeks ago in Gaza, but the group's goal is the same, to exchange prisoners with Israel.
The only way to bring our hostages back is by capturing Israeli occupation forces.
In retaliation, Israeli tanks, warplanes, and gunboats have crossed the border into southern Lebanon for the first time in 6 years. Joining us is Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. And Greg, can you give us some context, because the spotlight has been on the Israeli border with the Palestinians. How frequent has the skirmishing on this border with Lebanon been?
Well, there is a lot of shooting across the border, but it's sort of been played by a certain set of rules, and usually that has been Hezbollah would fire some rockets into Israel, Israel would strike back with some artillery or airstrikes of its own, and you might see a day of heavy shooting, and often that would be the end of it and things would cool down. But with Hezbollah seizing these two Israeli soldiers and Israel sending troops into southern Lebanon, we have a much larger crisis on our hands.
Yeah, Israel has launched an aggressive response and is placing responsibility in the hands of the Lebanese government. What is Israel saying?
Right. Israel says that while Hezbollah carried out this act, they hold the Lebanese government responsible. And this has been an ongoing issue for several years, ever since Israel left southern Lebanon. Hezbollah, this Shiite militant Islamic group, basically controls Lebanon's southern border. Their fighters are on that southern border. Israel has said that the Lebanese government should take control of that border and disarm Hezbollah. And 2 years ago, there was a United Nations resolution to that effect, but nothing has really changed.
And now we have this renewed demand. What position does that put Lebanon in?
Well, Lebanon hasn't really said very much, at least the government hasn't said very much so far. However, they're sort of hinting or have in the past said that they don't have that much control over Hezbollah and they should not be held accountable. So we can see a real problem or confrontation here. Israel has taken steps in the past of bombing power plants in Beirut to show that they hold the government in Beirut responsible, because Hezbollah is also a much more elusive target, hiding out in villages around South Lebanon.
And as we recall, Israel has also in the past acceded to a demand for a swap. What has it said this time in response to Hezbollah's demand for a swap of prisoners in Israel for these two soldiers?
Israel is saying no way right now. But in the past, or over many years, in fact, we've seen two kinds of Israeli responses. In some instances, they have used force, tried to rescue soldiers or civilians that were captured, and had some rather dramatic successes in some instances and failures in others. But they have made some trades. In fact, just 2 years ago, the Israelis traded 400 prisoners, both Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners, in exchange for an Israeli businessman who is being held in Lebanon and the bodies of three Israeli soldiers. So we have seen these kinds of deals in the past. I certainly wouldn't rule it out, but right now Israel says they're not going to negotiate.
Well, and this unrest with Lebanon, or at least across the border, comes as the tensions in Gaza heighten. Early today, Israeli forces moved further into central Gaza. They dropped a quarter-ton bomb on a Gaza home, officials saying it was an attempt to assassinate top Hamas fugitives, but the blast killed 9 members of a Palestinian family, at least according to the hospital there. In the minute we have left, how is this all resonating in the region?
Well, tensions are sky high. What began as a crisis over this one Israeli kidnapped soldier back in June 25th, a little over 2 weeks ago, is now threatening to, I wouldn't say engulf the whole region, but draw much more of the region into the conflict. Now you have the fight in Gaza, you have the fight on the Lebanese border. Israel is pointing the finger at Syria, saying that they host the Hamas leadership, but they also support Hezbollah. So other countries are being drawn into this conflict, and therefore it has the potential to continue escalating.
And just a couple seconds here, but do we know anything about the two soldiers who were captured this morning? Do we know where they are or how they are?
No, we don't. Apparently, they were in a jeep on a patrol right along the border when the Hezbollah men managed to come across and grab them. Hezbollah says they've taken them to a safe place, but we don't know anything about their condition or where they might be held in Lebanon.
Greg Myrie, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times, speaking from Jerusalem. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, to the Gulf region here, a groundbreaking trial that could alter the way insurance companies cover water damage and maybe the way consumers shop for insurance is taking place this week in Gulfport, Mississippi, a place still recovering from Hurricane Katrina. A Pascagoula, Mississippi couple claims they were denied coverage of damage caused by Hurricane Katrina's wind-driven storm surge. Their insurance company, Nationwide Mutual, says wind damage is covered, but flood damage isn't, and they consider wind-driven storm waves flood damage. It's the first of about 3,000 lawsuits filed in the wake of Katrina, and the outcome could affect insurance coverage nationwide. Gary Michel is with Mississippi Public Broadcasting. He joins us to talk more about this trial. Welcome, Gary.
Good afternoon.
And could you clarify for us, because this is something that many people are familiar with, even if they haven't been in floods, which is water damage and how it's covered by insurance companies. Nationwide Mutual and other insurance companies make a distinction between wind-driven water, let's say rain, and other waters, don't they?
Yes, they do. If the wind has damaged the roof and the rains, the torrential rains normally that come with hurricanes, come in through the roof, then they do cover that. They consider that part of the wind damage. However, if it is wind-driven, as in storm surge, and comes in from the ground up, they do not cover the water damage. And if there's water in the home, they no longer cover the roof damage where rain comes in.
Huh.
So they exclude water entirely.
Well, in addition to the disagreement over whether or not wind-driven storm surge water should be covered, which some people feel it should be covered, this couple, a policeman and his wife, are saying they were told they didn't need any extra kind of special flood insurance to cover hurricane wind-driven flood water.
In 1999, Paul Leonard went to his insurance agent, Jay Fletcher, and said, am I covered for flood, or do I need flood insurance? And Mr. Fletcher replied, you don't need that stuff. There was an expletive there, but we'll spare that, because you have hurricane coverage. So at that point, Mr. Leonard felt certain, with the reassurance from Mr. Fletcher, his insurance agent, that he had had for 16 years, that he didn't need to buy the flood insurance policies.
Well, let me stop you there. So, Mr. Leonard, the policeman, did have hurricane coverage, but it didn't cover flooding?
That's correct.
But he doesn't find this out, I'm gathering, until after his home floods and he goes to get coverage. How is Nationwide responding to this idea that with hurricane coverage you wouldn't get flooding coverage? I mean, wouldn't that be something a lot of people would assume?
You would, but most insurance companies, as did Nationwide, made it very plain in the policy which is issued. There are about three pages where it disclaims water. It says that it doesn't cover water, it doesn't cover flooding, it doesn't cover storm surge or wind-driven wave action. However, the agent assured Mr. Leonard that it did. Now, in other trials, the same judge that's hearing this case has ruled that the wording in the insurance policy is law, unless an agent extends that policy or gives assurances that there is coverage for a particular area, and water is the area in this case. And the insurance company can be held binding by the agent's comments.
So what is Nationwide Mutual saying to the claim by the couple, the Mississippi couple, Mr. Leonard and his wife, that their agent did give him that assurance?
The spokesman for Nationwide is explaining Mr. Fletcher's comments this way. He said, yes, Mr. Fletcher told him he did not need flood insurance because his home was paid for, and if he had a mortgage, he would be required to have flood insurance. But he did not intend to tell him that he did not need flood insurance just for protection. And the Nationwide spokesman agrees there is a lack of clarity in the insurance agent's comments.
Wow, that seems like an understatement.
Yeah.
What's at stake here, Gary? Is it, you know, whether or not insurance companies do, you know, maybe should change their thinking and cover wind-driven flooding waters? or whether or not adjusters or agents have to be clearer with people when they buy their insurance? What's really at the heart of this?
At the heart of this particular case, the prosecuting attorney, Richard Scruggs, has in a deposition, which was taped and played in the courtroom, where Mr. Fletcher said he really didn't like to write flood insurance. He didn't make much money off of it. It wasn't worth the paperwork. That, I think, is going to be the key to it in this particular trial. Ultimately, most of the insurance companies have that water exclusion, and the flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance, is the answer. However, many people have been told if you don't live in the floodplain, then you don't need insurance.
So it sounds as if it's not about potentially changing how insurance companies cover water damage, but about changing a perception of whether or not you have to have flood insurance and whether you should push your agents to sell it to you.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It gets a bit more convoluted in that homeowners' policies do say that you have hurricane coverage and they have a hurricane deductible. They actually charge you for hurricane coverage. You read further down in, you find out that that's only if your roof blows off and you have water that comes in through the ceiling.
Right. Not if it comes up from the ground or from a wave.
That's correct.
Well, how is this debate resonating in that area so damaged by floodwaters?
Well, there were 170,000 homes destroyed or damaged heavily, and the community's sitting on the edge of their seat. If the Leonards are successful, by the way, Nationwide did pay them a claim.
How much damage did they have and how much did they get paid?
They had $130,000 worth of damage, and Nationwide paid them $1,600.
Right.
So in this case, I guess it would be $128,000 that Nationwide would have to pay this one client of theirs. And there are 3,000, not all with Nationwide, but there are 3,000 that Mr. Scruggs will represent.
Well, I know so far in the trial, people have testified who feel they're in the same position as the claimants, and there have also been meteorologists. There are expected to be more people to testify about wind and water and which came first and that debate. What's the sense of what the outcome might be, at least, just from the, people watching from the sidelines?
It will mean that this community can rebuild. There are many people who got claims denied, people who received pennies on the dollar, like the Leonards, and they're unable to rebuild their homes. Thus, they can't return to the community, and the community can't recover. They need people to work. They need people to live in this community. But without these funds from their insurance companies, it will be very, very difficult to rebuild their homes.
Gary Michel of Mississippi Public Broadcasting speaking to us about the groundbreaking trial taking place this week in Gulfport, Mississippi, challenging the way insurance companies covered the water damage in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Gary, thanks very much. Fascinating.
Thank you very much, too.
And just ahead, an archaeologist in New Orleans explains why the debris left by a devastating flood is heartbreaking, but also an archaeological gold mine. And later in the program, France asks its beloved soccer star, pourquoi? More coming up here and now. Making use of the debris from houses destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Stan King is building birdhouses out of boards from some of the destroyed homes. He's also using old license plates for the roofs. The finished birdhouses will sell for $100 apiece, and the money will go towards rebuilding efforts. Well, Shannon Lee Doughty also has an interest in the debris left by Katrina. She is an archaeologist at the University of Chicago, and she's made New Orleans her focus of study since 1995. She was working on sites there from previous disasters just before Katrina hit. Last fall, she acted as liaison between FEMA and the Louisiana Division of Archaeology in the aftermath of the hurricane, and she writes about New Orleans in the current issue of Archaeology magazine. Shannon joins us on the line from Chicago. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And you say that your work in New Orleans after Katrina transformed the way you see the archaeology of New Orleans as well as the archaeology of disaster. First of all, what do you mean by that second phrase?
The archaeology of disaster?
Yeah.
Well, the very history of archaeology itself goes back at least to the discovery of Pompeii in the 18th century, in the 1700s. And so the archaeology of disastrous sites has been a subject for archaeologists for a very long time, because disasters have a tendency to preserve sites and create quite an extensive archaeological record.
Because they pile things under things.
Right, and they destroy lots of our material life, so we tend to throw a whole lot away right at that moment.
Well, tell us about that, because that's one of the things that you say you learned, is that as you were doing your work, you saw that people in the past had thrown away things, and you made a connection to today through that.
Right. There's a site I worked on in the late 1990s that's located in the French Quarter. Many tourists may know it, actually. It's called Madame John's Legacy. And it's a 1700s-style house, and we discovered a trash pit that clearly dated to a historic fire that we know about that destroyed most of the French Quarter in 1788. And it was quite fascinating to find a deposit that dated exactly to one day in time, over 200 years ago.
Right. It would be as if finding something that related to a trash pit from Katrina. And what you found were, for instance, very expensive buttons. And you wondered, well, why would anyone throw these away? And what conclusion did you come to?
Right. They weren't, not only were they expensive, but there were whole sets of them. And it was clearly that what had happened is they had thrown away fire-damaged or smoke-damaged clothes. And with decay, the only thing left were the bone buttons. And that and the conditions of other things in the trash pit told me that people threw things away rather hastily and didn't really go through an effort to salvage much. And as I was helping friends toss things out in New Orleans from their damaged houses, I encountered different responses to the disaster, but one common response is to just throw it all out without looking and start fresh, and that emotionally that is a way to move on and get on with one's life.
In fact, you write that emotions can shape the archaeological record. Is that what you mean?
Right, and that's one of the things that became clear to me from my time in New Orleans in the fall during the early cleaning and rebuilding process.
Yeah. You did a lot of practical work, like, you know, racing ahead of bulldozers to make sure that, you know, archaeological sites weren't destroyed. But you also had a lot of human interaction. How much was that a part of your work?
Well, personally, it was a very important part of my work, talking to people and understanding what their personal experience is like in the context of the aftermath of a disaster has informed my thinking a lot. And archaeologists in the U.S. are trained also as anthropologists. So doing ethnography, talking to people, and understanding how that relates to what they leave in the ground is a very important part of the intellectual process.
Right. And yet you know, too, that even though we can learn from past disasters and archaeological studies, there was something unique about today in that people today have more stuff.
Right. The sheer volume of our material lives now is unprecedented, and particularly in the very wealthy U.S. So the archaeological record of this disaster will be not unique, but going towards an extreme end of things. And in fact, there are struggles even now that one landfill is completely filled up and they're trying to open another. And these social conflicts over what to do with the debris from a disaster is part of the process that creates an archaeological record. And it's also interesting to think about what politics may have determined the disposal of disaster remnants, you know, in the prehistoric past as well.
You say because of the past, New Orleans is the city that it is. You say the city wouldn't be what it is without disasters, listing hurricanes and floods, and you mentioned fires, yellow fever, cholera epidemics. What do you think it will be because of Katrina?
Well, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball for the urban planning process, but certainly sections of the city will, if they will be rebuilt, will be rebuilt quite slowly. And the kind of architecture, I think, will transform, that we will actually go back to a smarter kind of construction for the region, which is raised homes, raised Creole cottages, where the first floor is really for storage and not for habitation, so that when you do have floods. And many of these houses, people need to understand, prior to those ranch houses built in the 1970s, many of them have flooded two or three times before, so we need to put this in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Why is New Orleans so fascinating for an archaeologist?
Well, in part because it's a historic and prehistoric diversity. It's been a crossroads for, you know, at least 1,000 years, the same sort of location that makes it a success also makes it a somewhat risky place to live.
And also a risky place to keep our history. You write it's the area with one of the largest concentrations of historic resources in the country?
Right. In terms of existing architecture and the integrity of neighborhoods that have not been demolished by quote-unquote urban renewal, because in some ways people are so tied to traditions and proud of their past in New Orleans. They have, in fact, many times before put themselves in front of the bulldozer to try to protect their history, and you're going to see that happening again in New Orleans. I mean, I think part of the thing that people don't understand, and I hope that the focus stays on New Orleans and Katrina, is this will be a 10-year process, and the threat to archaeological sites is really in the rebuilding, not really even in the cleanup or the storm itself and the levee breaks.
That's Shannon Lee Doughty, Assistant Professor of Archaeology at the University of Chicago. Shannon, thanks so much for speaking to us about New Orleans.
Okay, thank you.
And this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, what's not to like about laws from the Civil Rights era that protect minorities' access to the ballot box? Well, we'll take a look at the debate about the Voting Rights Act, which is up for congressional renewal. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is...
Boxy gets crushed by Zidane.
All of France is waiting. It's expected that the country's fallen hero, soccer great Zinedine Zidane, will speak soon, and he may answer the question, why? Why did he headbutt Italian defender Marco Materazzi in the last 10 minutes of the final game of the World Cup, ending his own career on a note of disgrace and perhaps losing the cup for the French? Zidane was taken out of the game, and France suffered a humiliating defeat. Molly Moore is Paris bureau chief for The Washington Post. And Molly, from what we read, toute la France is in despair over this. Can you explain why? What does Zidane mean to this country?
Well, he was one of the few national heroes France really had. He was very much looked up to. He came from a very rough neighborhood in the southern port city of Marseille. His parents immigrated to France from Algeria. He was born here in France, and he was one of the greatest soccer players of his generation.
You say one of the few national heroes, also one of the very few Burros. Is that how it's said, a Frenchman of North African descent?
Well, he was one of the very few minority heroes mm-hmm. in all of France. Mm-hmm. You know, there are very few Algerians or children of immigrants of either Africa or North Africa who have risen to any level of prominence in the country. He was one of the very few, so he was a role model for quite a few people in this country.
Well, some are speculating maybe it was too much what was asked of him to be a symbol of reconciliation of the racial divisions of France, we read. Perhaps one writer says, by extension, a symbol of reconciliation of racial divisions in the world. Even though, by the way, he wasn't Arab, he was ethnic Algerian, he wasn't Muslim, he was Christian. He was sort of put on a pedestal and asked to heal those wounds.
Well, the whole team was seen as sort of an important symbol of what France is becoming. The team was aging. It was getting older. It had come under some criticism for that. And it's one of the few examples of racially and ethnically mixed organization in all of France. It may be, you know, a bit too much ascribing that this kind of pressure led to the action in the game. He has a history of being hot-headed. In fact, in 1998, he was red-carded from the World Cup when he stomped on a Saudi Arabian player, and the French press has counted about 14 incidents when he's been removed from games over the last several years for his hot temper.
Yeah. And still, he's held up as an icon, especially for kids. I mean, we're reading of social workers in eastern Paris suburbs saying things like, you know, whatever we say to the kids now, like don't fight with kids from the next housing estate, housing project, or don't attack buses or police cars. Their answer will be, et Zizou alors? And what about Zizou then? I mean, people are really feeling that it's almost as if the whole country will now go by the wayside because of this.
Well, I don't think that will happen. In fact, it was really interesting on the day after the World Cup when the team came out on the balcony of the Crillon Hotel overlooking the Place de la Concorde in Paris, and there was a crowd of about 10,000 fans, and one of the people we interviewed in the crowd was a father who was there with his 8-year-old son, and he said his 8-year-old son had been watching the game with him and was just so distressed when he saw what happened that he basically didn't speak to the family for the rest of the night. And the father said, you know, I'm at a loss to explain to my son, you know, why this happened and how it happened.
Well, Americans can relate to that. I mean, we've had sports scandals in this country. Kids get depressed about it. But it seems to have extra importance in France, where recently young people have been rioting. Is there a connection there, or is there a concern there?
Well, there is concern. You know, these neighborhoods, like he came from, and the neighborhoods where there was violence and arson last fall, all across France, there is a great racial and ethnic divide in this country. And the neighborhoods, the poorest neighborhoods, unlike the United States, where ghettos and slums tend to be in the inner cities, France has built them in its suburbs. And this is where many of the immigrants and the children of immigrants who have come to France in the last generation live. It's the kind of neighborhood where he grew up in Marseille. It's the kind of neighborhood where kids now living looked up to him as one of their heroes.
So tonight, Zidane is expected to say why. Why he did what he did, why he headbutted defender Marco Materazzi. Now, Materazzi has said that Zidane looked at me with super arrogance. It's true, I shot back with an insult. But he went on to say, you know, just your average soccer insult. What is the speculation about what happened on the field and what Zidane might say?
Well, so far it's only speculation, and hopefully tonight we'll hear the answers. The speculations has been anything from he made a slur against Zidane's mother to there were some reports that he called him a terrorist, to which the Italian player has denied that he called him a terrorist. So tonight I think much of the country is probably expecting him to give something of an apology to the country for letting the country down. We had reports in the French press the day after the World Cup that basically he cried much of the night. He was so distraught over what he'd done. So it's a little early to speculate on what he's going to say, but he's obviously prepared to give some sort of explanation to the country that still holds him up as a great hero.
And by the way, we should point out there was so much curiosity about what was said on the field that I think the BBC hired a lip reader.
Several British newspapers hired lip readers who claimed that you know, the comments were both derogatory to his mother and were calling him a terrorist. But again, that's speculation, and hopefully tonight, you know, we hear from the man himself what actually happened, or at least his version of it.
You say the country still holds up, France still holds up Zidane as a hero. Why? What are they saying? Are they saying that maybe he's more human because of this? I mean, how so?
Well, there were several newspaper polls that came out in the last day or two, and in those polls, the majority of people polled said that they not only forgave him for what he did, but they understood why he might react that way if someone insulted him. This was, you know, not held against him as a flaw. It was, by many French, it's an unfortunate incident that happened, but perhaps, in their view, it was justified.
Mm. Amalie Moore, Paris Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. And Molly, again, for Americans who can't quite grasp, you know, how big this is, do you have a comparison? Do you have a way of, you know, driving it home?
Well, it's hard to find a comparison because I think while soccer is gaining importance and interest in the United States, I think most Americans who've never lived abroad will find it hard to understand just how important soccer is and how important the World Cup is. It's as though you had a Super Bowl with the entire world watching it instead of just America. So one of the issues here is this was seen by some as a smear, not only for the French team, but a smear against France in front of the entire world.
Mm. Molly Moore, I'm sure you'll be watching to see what Zidane says, as will we all. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Great to be with you.
And still to come today, a new film looks at America's troubadour, Woody Guthrie. You're listening to Here and Now. It's summer, and the gardeners among us know their parsley from their cilantro, their marigolds from their morning glories. But what about the rest of the riotous growth outside the garden gate? On a beautiful morning early in the growing season, Here and Now's Kim Matulewski went walking with naturalist Russ Cohen, a man who sees more than summer in all that plant life. He sees dinner. Kim wrote about her experiences in the new magazine Edible Boston, and now she brings us the story. And one quick warning, do not try this at home without some guidance. The results could be fatal. Russ is an expert. He's the author of Wild Plants I Have Known and Eaten.
Russ Cohen has been nibbling on the landscape ever since a high school biology teacher turned him on to edible botany. Today, his suburban home includes a large library of foraging books and a freezer full of food that has never seen the inside of a supermarket.
I always have steam stinging nettle greens in the freezer, and I usually have several different kinds of milkweed products like milkweed buds or milkweed pods in the freezer. Burdock, I almost always have burdock. Flower stalks in the freezer, and several different kinds of mushrooms.
And wild cranberries, acorn flour, and cattail pollen. The list goes on. Cohen says there are about 150 edible wild plants in New England alone, and he's quick to add that foraging isn't so much a Boy Scout's survival skill as a pleasure-filled pastime and a path to good eating.
For me, foraging is just a great way to enrich all the time I spend outdoors. So whether I'm hiking in the woods or walking along the rocky coastline, there's edible wild plants all over the place. So it's a great way to connect to the outdoors through your taste buds as well as through all your other senses.
On this day, Cohen leads a small group on an introductory tour of the outdoor produce aisles. On the edge of an organic farm north of Boston, we begin by searching for buried treasure, the edible roots of the groundnut plant. Last summer, Cohen saw the viney, water-loving shoots growing right around here. Trouble is, they haven't sprouted yet this season.
So just pick a spot and just dig into the ground a little bit and see if you come up with anything.
Okay? What do they look like?
They're tubers on a string. On a little rooty string, and they're separated out by about an inch or two. And I didn't find any in my first dig here.
So they're not really nuts. They're tubers,
right,
like a potato.
Right, it's like a potato-like device. Okay. I know they're here, so if we keep digging, we will find them.
That promise of something interesting and delicious. But the uncertainty, too, that's the sport of foraging, especially for beginners who don't quite know what they're looking for.
Okay. I found a little one, so at least we know. Okay, this is what we're looking for. Okay. These are the little groundnut tubers. They can get, see, that's more like a normal size one, but they can get bigger than a golf ball.
Cohen's find energizes everyone. The scraping and digging intensifies. Now we're rooting in earnest.
Right. Look at it. Look at this one.
Yeah, there we go.
Beautiful. That's a good find.
Okay, bag.
Before long, we're all hitting pay dirt.
I got one.
All right.
I got a big one. I can feel it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, keep track of that vine. Let me get out a knife and I'll show you what it looks like inside. Okay, so you look in there. You see how starchy it is?
Cohen tells us it was groundnut, not corn, that may have sustained the pilgrims through their first tough winter in the New World. He says there's evidence they discovered a Native American cache of the root and ate it. Groundnuts can be eaten raw, but Cohen says they're better cooked. His favorite way to eat them is sliced and fried like potato chips. But that would come later, after we'd met some other wild foods, like Japanese knotweed, burdock root, wild onions, and live forever leaves. For now, we're satisfied by our find and the fun we had searching for it. By day's end, no one is ready to give up the grocery store, but we all have a feel for an older way of eating and a new sense of possibility for the table.
That was producer Kim Matulewski on Expedition Near Boston with expert forager Russ Cohen. And again, note the word expert. Do not try this on your own unless you get Russ or someone like him to go with you. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
I'm just a roaming round, just a wandering worker, I go from town to town.
At a time when American cities boomed, Woody Guthrie sang about rural America. He was the last of the wandering heroes, bucking industrial life and singing about the people that new life left behind. Woody Guthrie Ain't Got No Home airs tonight on Public Television's American Masters series. It includes reflections by Bruce Springsteen, Woody's daughter Nora, and of course, music. Some of the songs are recently discovered tracks laid down for a defunct record label. It includes what's thought to be the first recording of This Land Is Your Land, which you'll soon hear. Director Peter Frumkin joins us to tell us more about his film. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, and I want to just sort of go through quickly the things that people might feel they know so that we can get to the things that, you know, maybe they'd never heard of. We know, or many know, that Woody Guthrie was from Oklahoma, born into a relatively well-off family that lost what they had. He was well aware of the Dust Bowl immigrants. He hitchhiked around with them, got out to Los Angeles, started sort of playing the part of a hick on radio, and then went to work for a newspaper and was assigned to go out and report on the Okies. And you say there was sort of a transformation in there.
Yeah, there was a point where he started spending more time in California's Central Valley. The Central Valley was where the migrant workers who he'd been traveling with for the previous couple of years had settled down to try and make a living after they'd left the Dust Bowl. And it was there that he really started to see the living conditions that they were experiencing. And as we discussed in the film, they were horrible. People were living in shacks. It was, as one person says, not much better than slave conditions.
Here, we want to listen to Woody Guthrie himself speaking of the migrant workers who so inspired him to write.
If people would sit and tell me that there was hundreds and thousands of families living around under railroad bridges and the old cardboard houses and old orange crates that they'd been able to tear up and get boards out of, I wouldn't believe it.
At this point in your tale, he goes from being sort of a populist, you know, hee-haw guy to a political singer.
That's right. At some point, he is introduced or invited to sing in front of a Communist Party rally. And he sees these are people with whom he has common cause. We should say it wasn't that unusual a thing to be a communist, or at least to be very leftist at that point in American history.
And this was way before the McCarthy hearings. This was a very visible group of people who were protesting against some of the very conditions he was singing about.
That's correct. Right. It was this sort of broad left coalition that were really the only people that were standing up for farm workers who were starving and lots of other people for whom the times were just very, very tough.
But, you know, we should say he was also embraced by New York intellectuals at a certain point. His biographer, Joe Klein, jokes in the film, though, that Woody Guthrie's allegiance was based on getting paid because communists were, at that point, well-off people who had money. So how deep were his loyalties?
I think his loyalties were actually pretty deep. And there, in fact, there's some criticism of him that he stuck with the Communist Party longer than he should have. Without getting too detailed about the politics, there was a critical turning point in which a lot of people became disenchanted with the party, and Woody stuck with them. One comment that's been very common about his relationship to the party, though, is that he was just never disciplined enough to be part of the party. He would never toe the party line, so they may never have invited him to join the
party.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
Yeah. You write he was on a cross-country trip across the U.S., and this is 1940, and he heard God Bless America, which was like the number one song in the country at that time. And he wrote This Land Is Your Land in response to that?
Yes, he wrote This Land Is Your Land. The original tagline for the song was not This Land Is Your Land, it's Did God Bless America for Me. And he thought that Kate Smith's version of the song was just this very saccharine, sappy song that didn't really apply to an America that he knew. He knew an America that was filled with people that were having a hard time feeding their families, having a hard time finding work, just having a hard time getting by. And it didn't seem like a very blessed place to him and his people at that point.
A protest song in many ways, but it was embraced. And it's interesting to be reminded as well that Woody Guthrie wrote songs for the government, for the WPA. He wrote songs for Hollywood. They called to have him write the songs for the film version of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. He wrote the song about Tom Joad, played by Henry Fonda, in the film version. He's the Dust Bowl migrant-turned-activist. I love the John Steinbeck quote about Woody Guthrie's song.
Yes, John Steinbeck allegedly said, you know, that dirty little so-and-so, I can't say this on the radio, but took me 2 years to write that book, and he got the whole thing in 17 verses.
Yeah. Let's listen.
Now the 12 of the Joads made a mighty heavy load, but Grandpa Joad did cry. He picked up a handful of land in his hand, said, I'm staying with the farm till I die. Yes, I'm staying with the farm till I die.
You remind us of the tragedies in Woody Guthrie's family. I mentioned that at least I thought in watching the film it appeared that his mother was psychotic, maybe mentally ill. She set a fire that killed his sister. She almost killed Woody Guthrie's father by throwing fire on him. But then it's explained later when Woody Guthrie discovers that he is diagnosed with Huntington's disease, that that's the illness his mother had?
Yeah, his mother had Huntington's disease. At the time, it was called Huntington's chorea, not Huntington's disease.
But it doesn't manifest as what sounded like a mental illness?
Yes, it can have some very, very striking behavioral effects, and Woody began to suffer from them as well. He appeared to be drunk a lot of the time, and he was often not very drunk. There was a critical moment when his wife, Marjorie, realized that he appeared to be very, very drunk, but Marjorie realized that he was not drunk, and that's when she knew that something very, very bad was going on with him.
And that he could be as violent towards her and his children as his mother was towards his family. And it seemed that this illness in him was triggered by another event in his life where his wife, who he loved very much, left their daughter alone, and another fire started, and his daughter was killed. He just didn't seem to recover from that.
I wouldn't say that the disease was triggered by that event, but I would say that perhaps some of his depression and some of his downward spiral was probably triggered by that. It was a terrible thing. He deeply loved this little girl like he hadn't, or he may not have deeply loved his first three children. But he had, at this point in his life, figured out how to be a responsible father and a loving father. And it was a terrible, terrible loss for him.
And he was never the same after that. Bob Dylan comes to New York, looks up Woody Guthrie in the hospital, goes to visit him, tries to pull him back into the folk song orbit, and nobody really recognizes him.
The disease had so overcome him that he would occasionally make a public appearance. He would go out into Washington Square Park or someplace like that, and people might not know who he was because he was in such tough shape.
Yeah. What are you saying overall in the film about the story of the life of Woody Guthrie?
Guthrie's life is an amazing life. It's both extremely optimistic and extremely tragic at the same time. And what's optimistic about it is that despite all of these terrible things that happened to him, he was a tremendously creative and prolific person. My sense is that Woody Guthrie lacked the filters that many of us have on our minds, that we all have lots of thoughts running around our head and lots of ideas running around our head. And we stopped them from getting out. And Woody poured everything out onto pieces of paper or whether he was writing or typing or whether he was drawing or painting. Just everything inside of his head came out. And that's a fascinating process to see.
Peter Frumkin, you say groups from the Klezmatics to the Dropkick Murphys, a punk band, are all recording Woody Guthrie. We'd like to close with one of our favorites. It's Remember the Mountain Bed from one of the two CDs of Woody Guthrie's music recorded by Billy Bragg and Wilco. Peter Frumkin is director of Woody Guthrie Ain't Got No Home. It airs tonight on the American Masters series on PBS. You'll find a link to local listings on our website, here-now.org. And Peter, thanks.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
I learned the reason why man must work and how to dream big dreams. To conquer time and space and fight the rivers and the seas. I stand here filled with my emptiness now. Look at city and land.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
A hot warm river's end.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.